Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on Iran with our speaker, Ben Teleblou, who is senior fellow at the Federation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C. Now, he's published widely in newspapers and made commentaries before Congress and whatever else. Our speaker's a Farsi speaker, and therefore well-equipped to talk on the topic tonight of Iran and the United States, an update, and thanks to the Australian Israel and Jewish Affairs Council who made this talk possible tonight. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction, and thanks to everyone for coming out this evening and seeing what I hope is not just about the best of American neckwear in Australia, but also to the Sydney Institute for hosting. So thank you very much. The topic, I think somewhat aptly and in respect for the news cycle, is called today Iran and the U.S., or Iran and the United States, an update. Now, what is there to update? When so much of what's going on in many ways is simply more of the same? Or to extend the metaphor, there's a phrase the founding father of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, used to say way back in the late 70s, early 80s, what business is there between the wolf and the sheep? In this regard, Khomeini kind of would jab at those who would talk about talking with America. And 40 years later, we are here in the month of September. A couple days later, there will be the United Nations General Assembly. And again, there is talk of talk between the U.S. and Iran. So depending on your perspective, who you think is the wolf, who you think is the sheep, we are still talking about discussions allegedly between the wolf and the sheep. Part of what got us here is this thing that is popularly called the Max Pressure Campaign, or the Maximum Pressure Campaign. That's basically a bumper sticker, if you will, used to define America's Iran policy since May 8, 2018 to present. And actually, while it is America's Iran policy, it's derived from the use of the primary foreign policy tool designed to deal with the North Korean nuclear and missile challenge from 2017 under the same administration, under the Trump administration. Because max pressure was first coined with respect to North Korean nuclear and missile tests. If you all remember back to the ancient historical days of 2017, in the days of fire and fury, that's when this pressure policy came about. And the pressure policy with respect to North Korea has been, or was, starting in 2017, been based on primarily multilateral sanctions driven by the engine of U.S. coercive diplomacy. And with respect to the other target, the other nuclear rogue, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Max Pressure Campaign has relied on the same tool, punitive and coercive economic measures, that's a fancy way to say sanctions, but unilateral sanctions, because it lacked that international support, that international consensus. That is what UN sanctions had and existed with respect to the North Korean target. So Max Pressure starts on May 8th, 2018. I know this is supposed to be a one-way type of feature, at least for the first half of the discussion, but can anyone tell me what the U.S. did on May 8th, 2018 that triggered this policy response, that triggered the current crisis?
They got out of the agreement.
Yes. On May 8th, 2018, the U.S. left this agreement called the JCPOA, colloquially. It's known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. And now I'm going to out myself with respect to the audience. I'm a critic of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The C in the deal, the JCPOA, comprehensive, in my view, didn't belong there. It wasn't a comprehensive agreement. If you look at it, it really deals with one of the many vectors that has made Iran an international pariah for the past 40 years. You think about that history of enmity between Khomeini and his successor Khamenei and the United States, the nuclear issue is really only the latest issue that has entered the fold of the conversation of why these two countries can't get along. Harken back to 1979, there was, of course, the hostage crisis, the Iran-Iraq War, 80 to 88, the reconstruction and reconfiguration of Iran's economic, domestic, foreign policy, and political scene throughout the 1990s, the rise and fall of the reform movement, the rise and fall of new conservative movements in Iran, the Ahmadinejad era, the era where Iran thought it would be wise to send a Holocaust denier wearing a polyester windbreaker to the United Nations General Assembly and have him represent that great country. So Mac's pressure is clearly built on a historical trajectory that the regime, and a trajectory that has been based on this enmity, this 40 years of enmity, and it's also based on an assumption that I think is borne out by evidence on how Iran has changed, if at all, its foreign and security policy. And the reason I caveated that change, if at all, is because in Washington, when you study cool or interesting foreign policy problems, you're often studying change. You're often looking for the delta between the current threat and the future threat, or something new from this administration to that administration, or the next country that you want to be talking about. It's always a story of change. For those of you who've been looking at the Islamic Republic of Iran in different iterations, in different times, it's not about change. The challenge is a challenge of continuity. Continuity of mission for Iran's revolutionary elites, continuity of repression for the Iranian population within the country. 1979 to 1980 is when the Islamic Republic itself was formed, came about through some distinct historical political forces in that country. And even as there was a referendum in 79 for an Islamic Republic, there have also been concurrent protests against an Islamic Republic. So as much as we know about Iran's domestic scene affecting Iran's domestic politics, it's also become part of the foreign policy challenge with respect to that country, because its domestic politics have been on quite a public display. All this is to say, of course, that the Max Pressure campaign commenced when the U.S. left the nuclear deal, cognizant of this historical legacy, cognizant of those domestic challenges, and cognizant of the continuity of Iranian threats despite different Iranian presidential administrations. The primary foreign policy tool that we discussed, economic sanctions, featured heavily in the Max Pressure campaign, and every single sanction that had existed in U.S. law, every single penalty, every single Iranian actor, be they a bank, a business, an individual, a procurement network, a proliferation network, that had been hit, had been sanctioned, if you will, from 2006, when the nuclear saga commenced and Iran's nuclear file went to the UN Security Council, all the way up until 2013, which is when diplomacy began really in earnest between the US and Iran through the P5 plus one, the five permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany. And all these entities that were waived starting in 2015 and 2016 with that JCPOA nuclear deal, all of them, pursuant to the Max Pressure campaign, were relisted, re-sanctioned, many under the same authority and many under different authorities, different tools, different laws, different vectors that the U.S. had to put pressure on Iran, different capabilities that Washington had to pressure Iran on the nuclear and non-nuclear files. The Treasury Department in Washington, which has been responsible for coordinating this sanction strategy, has called it the largest single day designation in its history. So when you're looking at some things that have made history, this Max Pressure campaign has made history. But it's also made history inside Iran, talking about an update. How did we get here? Well, why is Iran doing everything it's doing now, really since May 8, 2019, since the one-year anniversary of the U.S. leaving this deal? You can't open a newspaper or turn on the television and hear about some sort of new Iranian escalation, whether it's in the Persian Gulf, whether it's doing things incrementally with the nuclear deal, whether it's cracking skulls at home, whether it's aggression abroad, whether it's things even in cyberspace that are reported later on in different newspapers in different countries. How did this happen? Well, it happened because Iran's strategy in response to this Max Pressure campaign, this large single day relisting of every single sanction basically on Iran in U.S. history, was actually not to run towards the problem initially. It was to wait out the problem. I venture to you that if you're going to divide out Iran's foreign policy responses to max pressure, the first year, from May 8, 2018 to May 8, 2019, largely but not exclusively, Iran's policy was one that you could call strategic patience. In fact, you know, if you're familiar with Iran's political system, there's a national security body called the Supreme National Security Council. Its secretary is actually Iran's highest-ranking Arab. His name is Ali Shamkhani. The president sits there. That body can also give advice to the supreme leader. Supreme leader's name is Ali Khamenei. One can imagine this body convening of military men, political men, and, of course, religious men, holy men, and convening, and with this, drawing on this Islamic injunction, which is, I'm going to give you the Arabic first and then translate it, which is Inna la ma sabirin, which is verily God is with the patient. So the Iranians, who thought right was on their side, who thought they could outlast the Trump administration, and who through this new source of information, the European Union, thought that the max pressure campaign, given how new it was, and given that it was rooted in an entirely different foreign policy target, North Korea, thought that they could outlast the Trump administration, that the president would be a one-term president. And more importantly, remember that differentiation between North Korean and Iranian sanctions as emanating from the U.S. or emanating from the U.N.? The sanctions against Iran did not have a shared international consensus in their defense. And the primary body of strategic literature on non-kinetic tools of coercion, that's just a fancy way to say non-military ways to pressure someone, says that you should have as much international support for that non-military way to pressure someone as possible. And lo and behold, the Trump administration did not have this support in May. You know, if you straw poll most Washington audiences, non-official audiences, non-government audiences, there were many in favor of staying in the nuclear deal. I myself, who am a vociferous critic on the nuclear, missile, military, economic merits of the deal, was not for leaving the deal on May 8th. I thought that you could work with the European Union, our transatlantic partners in America, to fix the deal, to first establish a framework to unite the West, so that Iran's President Rouhani, who's spoken at length about keeping the transatlantic community divided, could not accomplish this again. But lo and behold, the sanctions go forward unilaterally. A couple of months go by. They're actually phased in two batches. In August of 2018, the first batch. In November of 2018, the next batch. And ultimately, you enter 2019. You start looking at the Iranian economy. And you start to see something very interesting. That the macroeconomic indicators that you use to assess the health of an economy began to shift rapidly into the red, rapidly into the negative. Something people thought could not happen if only one country was sanctioning only one other country, and the majority of countries were on the sidelines, indifferent or against the sanctioning of one country to another country. Now, how did the U.S. achieve this? One is market forces. Market forces, U.S. economic clout, the strength of the dollar, the fact that we all share an international banking and business system that in some way touches New York, that in some way relies on the strength of the greenback, the dollar, that in some way ends up touching a U.S. entity or a U.S. person. There's some touch points between transactions all around the world today that are international and that are also linked to the U.S. financial system. And a broad definition of transactions that involve U.S. financial person, the U.S. financial system, and a broad definition of what involves a U.S. entity, and a broad definition of what involves a U.S. person, was used cleverly in a form of lawfare. And in place of this shared consensus, really in the first time in human history, market forces became the force multiplier for foreign policy success. This is an impressive feat of U.S. unilateral sanctions that has not been accomplished on another target set, not even on North Korea, where there is much more consensus. And in many countries that are considered friends, partners, allies of Washington, you would look at the policy of the national government, the policy of London, the policy of Berlin, policy in Paris towards Iran, and it was doggedly attached to the JCPOA nuclear deal, finding ways to keep it alive. But still, banks, large businesses, financial institutions ended up somewhat reluctantly, but nonetheless, siding with Washington for the sake of their commercial economic interest, rather than siding with the national capital where their bank or business was housed and headquartered. This impressive use of banknotes over bullets came to define the new way the Trump administration was going to deal with not just the Iranian nuclear saga, which again we said is only the latest iteration of threat and challenge in the continuous series of threats and challenge the Islamic Republic has posed to U.S. international security, but also the most interesting, because the Iranian strategy began to change in response to these successes. If you fast forward to April 2019 now, you're looking at these macroeconomic indicators of contraction. They're continuing to go in the red. I'd be happy to discuss what those indicators are, by the way, in the question and answer session. And in April 2019, you have some historic moments. For the first time, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is the tip of the revolutionary spear of the Islamic Republic, formally 125,000 strong. Iran has two militaries. This is somewhat smaller in terms of personnel, but in terms of resources, in terms of a more coherent ideology, in terms of service to the state and the state's revolutionary ideals, and in terms of ownership or control of Iran's most sensitive military portfolios, drones, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and yes, of course, the nuclear program. This entity is in charge, and this entity is for the first time, pursuant to State Department authorities, added to a list that has no state actor in it, always has non-state actors in it, and it's the U.S. State Department FTO list, the Foreign Terrorist Organization list. And in a move that people had predicted, and Washington had been debating internally with itself from 2007, whether or not to formally list the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps as a foreign terrorist organization, Trump administration ended that decade-ish long debate and added the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps to the foreign terrorist organization. And thus, in the same kind of clever and interesting way that U.S. had used economic power to press Iran, now it was looking to use legal power, because this broadened the legal definition of who did or didn't provide material support through transactions with a bank, business person, owner controlled by this entity, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Because while these guys are 125,000 strong formally, they have an informal network, which is the myriad veterans of the IRGC, men who fought and bled in the eight-year Iran-Iraq War, went into national politics in the 90s and went into large corporations in Iran in the 90s and benefited from the false privatization schemes you saw from the late 90s all the way into the Ahmadinejad administration, all the way into the early Rouhani administration, where one arm of the state bequeathed a major bank, a major sector of the economy, to the other. And in this process of privatization, these men earned significant dividends, and they were able to keep Iran on this revolutionary track. Remember, think of continuity, not change, in foreign security and domestic policy. So the first thing that happens in April, this entity is designated. The second thing is a move to really drive at the Islamic Republic's major financial artery. Anyone care to guess what is the major source of revenue for Iran? You can use
oil.
Well done. Yes, it is oil. And even the Trump administration, back in November, when it brought on the second phase of those two-part sanctions and engaged again in that largest ever single-day designation, did not decide to drive Iran's oil exports in November 2018 to zero. Market forces, different political conditions, risk, the fact that American adversaries, as well as American allies and partners, were still reliant on Iranian oil, that all impacted the calculation. The U.S. extended 8 waivers to these countries. And in April, the U.S. simply revoked the waivers. While Iran is still today not at zero, and technically oil transactions with Iran today are sanctionable, Iran is anywhere from 100 to 200,000, those are illicit transactions, barrels per day. Never before has Iran's oil exports fallen this low, perhaps with the small caveat of different periods of the Iran-Iraq War, when oil and shipping were targeted, both by both belligerents. And these two things really kicked the U.S. max pressure campaign into high gear, getting us closer and closer to today. And I venture to tell you that the reason you are hearing in the press, on TV, in newspapers, among speakers much more qualified than I, about Iran's escalation, about Iran's activities starting in April and May of 2019, is because there was a shift at the highest levels in Iran over how to respond to these successes, this max pressure success. Remember, in 1 year, essentially 1 year, the U.S. had been able to enact the same, if not greater, kind of pain on the Iranian economy that took over a decade at the multilateral level across the Bush, Obama, and early Trump administrations to do. Again, thinking of impressive feats. Continuity on the Iranian side, change on the American side. And so Iran's strategy shifts, I posit to you, from strategic patience, wait this out, to a policy I like to call incremental or graduated escalation. That's just a fancy way to say, you want to play chicken, we're game. And in this regard, Iran became more risk tolerant as opposed to risk averse. And how did it do this? Well, that's really the update. I want to make sure that this audience knows that Iran calculated the areas that it would be escalating in, the areas that it did escalate in, the areas I venture to tell you they will escalate in. While we may agree that they're zealots, while they may themselves call themselves revolutionaries, they are not fools. You don't get to have a system of government in Tehran continually subject to different levels of foreign, political, economic, and military pressure, and be fundamentally opposed to the prevailing norms, politics, values, ideals, interests of the international system, and still see a 40th anniversary. So something's got to give. And so what the regime did was find areas that the U.S., the Western alliance, and in fact much of the international community cared about, that it could inflame, and then commence the process of inflaming them. And this is I have another fancy term for this, and the fancy term is cross-domain escalation. You think about the theaters of conflict that exist in the Middle East. You think about the domains, the areas where we could easily slip into an accidental war with Iran, the areas where we could move into from the known quickly into the unknown. And through indirect contact, through proxy forces, through a bit of muscle and creativity, and the proliferation of some key systems, Iran commenced this policy of cross-domain escalation. I have been able to detect 5 domains. If you guys know more, do feel free to shout them out. But the 5 are, first of all, the Persian Gulf with the oil tankers. We'll get into that. Second, moving from sea onto land, the regional theaters, places where Iran or Iran-backed forces or politicians friendly to Iran are ascendant. I'm thinking right now about jurisdictions like Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Lebanon, possibly Bahrain, but these 4. That's 2. 3, of course, is the cyber domain. Remember, this is one of those covert domains where the Iranian capabilities are growing. After that, of course, is missiles. Missile testing, missile transfers. One of my fundamental qualms with the JCPOA nuclear deal is that it didn't address ballistic missiles sufficiently. It doesn't really address it at all in the text of the JCPOA. It's addressed insufficiently in the UN Security Council resolution that codifies and enshrines the JCPOA. Why do I care about ballistic missiles? Because Iran cares about ballistic missiles. More importantly, multiple American directors of national intelligence for over a decade under both Republican and Democratic presidents have said that Iran has the largest ballistic missile arsenal in the Middle East. Through open source analysis, we can also say that Iran's ballistic missile inventory is actually quite diverse. Solid fuel systems, liquid fuel systems, short range systems, medium range systems, satellite launch vehicles. And then you can move out from ballistic into other types of weapons, cruise missiles, anti-ship cruise missiles, land attack cruise missiles, and then a whole host of rockets which don't have a guidance system but are solid fuel that are easier to proliferate, cheaper to produce, but are less effective on the battlefield. This whole arsenal, not dealt with by the JCPOA. And the same directors of national intelligence have also put forward that if Iran were ever, if were on ever to develop and use a nuclear weapon, the way they would do it, the delivery vehicle for the nuclear weapon, would not be some suitcase bomb, but rather a ballistic missile. That would be the way they would be able to threaten, coerce, punish, deter their adversaries of the region, and if there is no range limitation anywhere outside of the region. So missile testing and missile transfers is the other domain. Now, there's one final domain I haven't mentioned, which is the most sensitive domain, which is the most central to how we're getting to here today. Anyone want to guess what that fifth domain is?
I would say Israel.
Israel would go in the region because it's the countries around Israel that they use to inflame. But what?
The land bridge between Iran and the Mediterranean.
Good use of the term. I actually have a report on that from June. With H.R. McMaster kindly wrote the intro. But no, that's also in the region. The fifth. Apologies for the shameless plug, by the way. The fifth domain. No, I don't think they were nuanced enough for that. But
North Korea.
No. Begins with N. Nuclear, yes. The whole thing that caused the crisis, the reason, right? Leaving the deal. The deal, I would venture to guess, is actually, I would want to tell you that the deal is more slated in Iran's interest than America's interest. Remember, when the U.S. left the deal on May 8th, many thought the rationale for when the U.S. left the deal was that it was a series of Iranian violations the president couldn't stand, or the president had some innate issue with the deal. The way the U.S. left the deal, it wasn't legalistic. It was political, meaning it wasn't about this violation and this violation necessitate this response. It was fundamentally about politics and policy, meaning that this thing we have given up, remember all those sanctions the Treasury Department put back? Those were all handicapped during the period of the deal. This thing that we've given up, this non-kinetic tool of punishment and coercion, is fundamentally not worth this thing that we have gained, which is a couple of limits on Iran's nuclear program. Yes, there are limits with different degrees of efficacy on different parts of Iran's nuclear program, but these limits are time sensitive. And while this handicap is permanent, these limits are time. There's a term for it. They sunset. They lapse with a period of time. And because Iran is getting richer during this time, it's like putting someone in time out for something bad they did in the past, but as opposed to having them be punished by being on the sidelines, you're actually paying them to stay on the sidelines. That is the logic that the administration cited, that fundamentally on its trade-off, it is a bad deal, and it left the deal. So Iran, which has been cognizant of the Trump administration's attempt to not just focus on the nuclear issue, but focus on this broad array of other things that Iran does, the regional issue, the terrorism issue, human rights, even perhaps hostages that are in Iran, quite prescient today as we talk about hostages in Iran, the three Australians, as well as the one from December. And the Trump administration's quest for a bigger, broader, better deal, the Iranians have an incentive to escalate gradually and force the Trump administration to accept not a bigger, broader, better deal, but perhaps a slightly modified, rewritten, paraphrased JCPOA. So that's why the fifth domain, out of all these five domains of cross-domain escalation by Iran, matters so much, which is why Iran can be a little bit more risk-tolerant in these four domains, do things that are more dangerous, have the Houthis fire a land attack cruise missile at a civilian airport, have the Houthis fire drones as dumb cruise missiles at civilian targets, have tankers be targeted by mines as if we were reliving history. Remember continuity? Iran used mines quite effectively during the Iran-Iraq War. Iran threatened freedom of navigation quite effectively during the Iran-Iraq War. But it's reverted to doing that again, to spook oil prices, to spook insurers, to spook regional countries that also are against Iran, that also might want to be in support of the max pressure campaign, and to get them to blink, to get them to swerve, to get them not to be supportive of the max pressure campaign. Iran is trying to rope-a-dope every single country, including Australia, and peel them away from the max pressure campaign. Right now, if I had to guess what they're doing with the hostages, it's designed to erode Australian resolve. Remember, PM Morrison, unlike many of America's transatlantic partners, at least reconsidered Australia's support for the nuclear deal. The European Union did not even do that. Australia is now part of Operation Sentinel, this American-led maritime coalition to ensure freedom of navigation between the Persian Gulf, Strait of Hormuz, and Gulf of Oman, an area of the world where over a fifth of the world's global oil supply traded on sea passes on a daily basis. And so, Iran commenced this graduated escalation strategy. In May, you had the multiple tanker attacks, but also in May, you had, going back to that one most sensitive area, the nuclear area, on May 8th, Rouhani, Iran's president, laid out timetables for escalation, timetables for how we would get here. And these timetables were based every 60 days, and rather than have Iran egregiously leave the nuclear deal, Iran would incrementally leave the nuclear deal. And as it did so, it would take cover behind legalistic arguments of, well, we're just responding in kind to American sanctions, recreating the dynamic that as you sanction us, we'll grow our program, a dynamic that existed in the international community from 2006 to 2013, to grow the risks to us here. And the first thing that it did on May 8th, all the way up to early July, was to transgress stockpile limits that existed on its program in the deal. In the deal, the limits that existed on its stockpiles, some of them were just several limits, but the two main ones were a stockpile limit on how much heavy water Iran could have inside the country. Heavy water serves as a moderator in Iran's heavy water reactor. And then, of course, how much low-enriched uranium Iran could have in country. Low-enriched uranium is basically fissile material that would constitute the stuff that makes a nuclear warhead fissionable. So it basically is the weapons part of the ballistic missile arm with a nuclear warhead. If you enrich LEU, low-enriched uranium, all the way up to HEU, to 93%, that's how you have the sufficient uranium necessary for a weapon. And so they were going to breach the amount of LEU that they were going to keep in the country. July 7, the next 60-day period rolls around, and they decide to move the purity level up, go from 3.67, which is what the deal permitted, to just under 5%. Remember, when you're enriching uranium, not to make this a brief sideline about nuclear science, but as you're enriching uranium, the harder part is earlier on. You get to 20%, 20 to 60 is one jump, and 60 to 90 is another jump. But 0 to 5 and 5 to 20 are the key jumps. If you master those jumps, which Iran has mastered, you have basically mastered the technology. It becomes more a matter of time, more a matter of consistency, more a matter of arraying the centrifuges. These are the machines that spin uranium in the proper cascades and willing to actually move the enrichment level up. It becomes more of a political decision than a technical decision. So Iran breaches the purity cap in the JCPOA. And then most recently, September 6th, Iran has breached the centrifuge research and development, or R&D, caps that had existed in the nuclear deal on Iran. And these were already quite vague to begin with, but that means Iran can phase in more advanced machines and machines that can do more with less machines. So you don't need 1,000, you can have just a couple, because the output of these machines is higher. But it's also difficult to make these output higher over time, to be consistent over time. So they do this. And staring down the barrel of the gun here, you've had three Iranian incremental violations of the nuclear deal. You've had that cross-domain escalation. You've had a fairly consistent response by the Trump administration, which is more sanctions, growing the legal authorities, growing the political authorities, growing the economic authorities to use that same tool, coercive, punitive economic measures, to bring Iran to the table, not just for a photo op, but for a bigger, broader, better deal. And Iran is trying to disincentivize this one tool from working as well as it's done in the past. And the four things they're looking to do with respect to sanctions are, one, to slow the pace of the sanctions. Now, we're talking about an update here. Here's something worth knowing. Treasury Department has been on fire. You know, 2 weeks ago in Washington, Treasury Department put out about four or five press releases. And in each press release, a whole new series of entities, whole new series of persons under a whole new series, a whole different series of authorities have been hit. The Treasury Department is driving the engine of this sanctions policy. So the whole point of Iranian escalation is to slow the pace of these new sanctions. The second point of this escalation is, once you've slowed the pace, is to erode the political will to enforce these sanctions. Then once you've eroded the political will, then you put your request up. And your request is to waive certain sanctions, to grow the risk sufficiently to America while making the ask of, well, let me just sell some oil. Let me just sell a little bit of oil. And in fact, the Iranians have come out with a number of the oil that they want to sell. They want to sell 700,000 barrels. So clearly there's a calculation in Iran's larger deliberations here of to how much oil they need to sell, which is tied to a certain dollar amount, which they believe they can use to outlast Trump, and by doing so, outlast that one thing that we've been talking about today, the Max Pressure campaign. And if they get these three ducks in a row, and if they get a photo op, and if they get paid for coming to the table, they would have, through this risk-tolerance, graduated incremental escalation policy, be in the position to get the fourth and final thing, which is rather than just a slowing of the pace of sanctions, rather than just not enforcing sanctions, rather than waiving sanctions, they would have the U.S. in the position to lift the very same sanctions that brought them here in the first place. You know, we've talked about continuity, we've talked about a little bit of change, but now we're talking about deja vu, because the ultimate goal of Iran is to replicate the conditions that existed in 2013. In 2013, there is a phrase Iran's Supreme Leader used that when I heard, I fell out of my chair. It sounded a very interesting version. And also, I think many in Washington did not fully appreciate. And the phrase, I'll tell you first in Persian and then the translation, the accepted translation, I should say, is Narmeshi Qahramanane, which translates to essentially heroic flexibility, is the popularly accepted translation. And Khamenei, Iran's Supreme Leader, likens diplomacy, nuclear diplomacy with America to Iran's national sport, which is not soccer, like it is in many Middle Eastern countries. It's wrestling. Grappling with your adversary. Not being afraid to meet your adversary, to touch your adversary, to hold your adversary. But giving a little to get a lot. Being a little flexible tactically for a strategic win. To show a little bit of flexibility to have a takedown. And that's why I venture to tell you that the JCPOA was something the Iranians coveted, because they were able to crystallize through escalation on the nuclear file in 2013 a paradigm. And the paradigm was that the West needs a deal for political reasons more than Iran needs a deal for economic reasons. And if this paradigm crystallizes today, I would venture to tell you that the Iranians would have outlasted Max Pressure already. And if you do have some kind of premature photo op, if you do have some kind of selling of oil while Iran is still allegedly under sanctions, which would be a contradiction in and of itself, then you would have resurrected, remember, think about continuity, the same conditions that would allow Iran to win at the negotiating table that which they haven't necessarily won on the battlefield. And that, of course, is an update of the business between the wolf and the sheep. Thank you.
So many thanks to our speaker for a comprehensive run-through. So we come to question discussion. We'll finish no later than the top of the hour. Over the years, I think it's fair to say we've heard that there is a young group in Iran who will put pressure on the leadership, and eventually the leadership will concede and Iran will move to a kind of democratic form of government. But that never seems to happen. I mean, what's your view about the political situation? Is there great pressure politically on the regime internally, apart from the pressure that's going on through the Trump administration and other nations who are basically supporting the Trump administration on Iran, its Iran policy?
That's actually a great question, because while we've talked about continuity and change, a lot of it has been foreign-focused. I touched briefly on a few domestic touch points. But something that is consistent is the cleavage that you see in Iran between state and society. Fundamentally, the state remains a revolutionary state. Fundamentally, by all measures, empirical and anecdotal, Iranian society is post-revolutionary. Now, you mentioned young people, but that's not the only demographic. Women, trade unionists, artists, laborers, agriculturalists, people that you would expect would be opposed to the Khomeini legacy, who actually throughout the past 40 years have risen and fallen in their quest for more representative government, which, if we talk about continuity, is not just limited to the past 40 years, is actually part of the 100-plus-year Iranian quest for representative government, the 100-plus-year to rein in the power of the center and to empower the individual within the country. That was something that the constitutional revolution in Iran wanted. They wanted a parliamentary representative system, and they also wanted this thing called the House of Justice. They wanted justice in the state and justice in society, and I would venture to tell you they haven't attained those goals today. But that's something people both for and against the deal can agree on, because that's empirical. That's a want from before, and that's a lack of today. But in the present era, something I think the administration could be doing better is to highlight some of those protests. And in particular, in December 2017, all the way into the middle of 2018, there's been a whole new cadre of protests in Iran. And they haven't been as well televised as the Green Movement from 2009. This is the movement, of course, that was protesting the fraudulent Ahmadinejad re-election in 2009 in Tehran. But this protest, the December 2017 to mid-2018, and it's had different iterations continue, but a much more slower scale and much more geographically diffuse, have been from Iran's blue-collar community, the social base of the regime, the urban and rural poor, what Khomeini, the founding father, would call the mustazafan, the oppressed, the downtrodden and dispossessed, the people who you didn't necessarily need to pay to believe in the state because they believed in the state's governing ideology anyway. And when they, taking to the streets from all different strata, but primarily from this blue collar, but also echoed by anti-hijab movements, trade unionists, agriculturalists, environmentalists, even the Tehran Bazaaris, the people who bankrolled the revolution in the 70s, protesting outside the Iranian parliament in the summer of 2018, saying, "Our enemy is here," pointing to the parliament building, "and not in America." When those diffuse social forces, led by what should have been the vanguard of the Islamic revolution, end up echoing the nationalist criticisms of the central government, "Leave Syria, think about us, not Gaza, not Lebanon, my life for Iran," when they end up echoing those sentiments, it does give you hope. But in some ways, we suffer from the strengths of this movement. While there have been multiple different ideologies in Iran in the 20th century, from monarchism to Marxism, a panoply of different ideological forces, some of those ideological forces helped bring about the Islamic Revolution in 1979, ultimately, because these forces want life rather than to die for something they believe in, they want to live in a better Iran rather than to die and not see that better Iran, they are in some ways ill-equipped to stand before weapons of torture. They're in some ways ill-equipped to stand before what fortunately has not happened yet, which is tanks on the streets, that kind of thing. And the voices of moderation are inherently going to be more moderate, more quiet, and won't risk life and limb for a different kind of Iran, because they simply can't. That's why the December 2017 protests matter so much, because it's not just the voice of moderation, it's what happens when you put so much pressure from the center onto the periphery on those voices, and they crack out. And so the administration should stand with these voices, echo these voices, amplify these voices, take cues on the streets from these voices, don't get ahead of these voices. That's all. Be humble and prudent and respectful to the quest for representative government in Iran. But to make it related to max pressure, as much as there is, balancing this cup here, as much as there is a desire to diminish Iran's revenues coming in from abroad this way and put pressure on the central government from outside, there is also something that the regime fears the same amount, if not more, than a balance of payments crisis derived from foreign sanctions. And that is this domestic pressure. And if these two forces ever meet in the middle, then you really know the regime is in trouble.
Okay, thank you. There's a question down there. And we've got a lot of people who are going to be brief with our comments.
Yep. Two very quick questions. First thing, what effect, if any, did Israel's discovery of those 100,000-page documents have either in Iran or internationally? And secondly, why is Iran ramping up, putting lots of proxies throughout both Iraq and Syria, with a lot of its weaponry?
Well, firstly, you might just back around the 1,000 pages for a second.
Sure. Two great questions. I'll do my best to be brief because there were a couple of other hands. But the first thing you mentioned, the 100,000 pages, is something called the Atomic Archive. It's basically Iran proving that it's hedging with respect to its nuclear program, continuing to keep critical information about nuclear weapons design, about past projects, about getting a warhead onto a ballistic missile system. Unfortunately, when these were revealed in the spring of 2018, many immediately, without even looking at these documents, had actually ended up just dismissing them, that it's nothing new, it's more of the same, it's stuff that we saw in a couple of International Atomic Energy Agency reports. But there's things we've learned about Iran's program through these documents, many of which have been published online, some of which I've had the privilege of translating from Persian into English. A footnote to history, if you will. Things about neutron initiators in Iran. Things about the Fordo fuel enrichment plant, which is the fuel enrichment plant basically under a mountain close to but not in the holy city of Qom in central Iran. And the fact that this facility, which was revealed by the US, UK, and France in 2009, and ultimately did enrich uranium to low grades, was initially designed for high-enriched uranium. There's a plethora of these little gems, unfortunately, in these documents. There's lots of Iranian persons, entities that have not been sanctioned that play a role in the development of Iran's nuclear program. And so, unfortunately, within Iran, it didn't make much of a splash within the population. But abroad, it's increasingly making a splash. And the IAEA has actually investigated one of the facilities that house these things and actually has found trace amounts of uranium. And that puts Iran in a precarious situation. And that precarious situation is it may not just be in violation of this JCPOA, but it may be, in violation of more central non-proliferation and arms control agreements. Things like the Comprehensive Safeguards Agreement or things like the Additional Protocol, these foundational international non-proliferation treaties, because Iran hadn't declared the presence of fissile material there. So really, I think the regime realizes that what's left of its nuclear program is in the crosshairs, not military crosshairs, but in the light, is in the crosshairs of public scrutiny of coming more into light. Second question about proxies. Never before have I seen a country so cognizant of its conventional military deficiencies as Iran. Iran's proxy strategy is ideologically coherent, strategically coherent. It's part of the export of the revolution, basically this long-standing foreign insecurity policy, but also ideological project of the regime to spread the revolution. In the 80s, this was done much more crassly. These days, it's done a little bit more skillfully. But the proxy network in places like Iraq and Syria allow the regime to be active on the ground at a lower level and be able to shape a conflict's trajectory earlier and be able to control the chaos that exists in places like Iraq and Syria. And so rather than have to send your own formal forces, which would tip your hand and then thus invite more retribution and ruin, perhaps against your homeland, the proxy network allows you to fight abroad without fully having to be abroad. Consider this, the best defense is a good offense, but we're the ones not playing offense, we're going to pay you to play offense. And in places around the Middle East, it's quite crass. If you look at Syria, there's a division, a brigade, if you will, called the Fatimiyun. This is Iran's all-Afghan Shia militia. Traditionally, these men dying on behalf of the Islamic Republic have been Shiite Arabs from the Middle East. This is Iran's all-Afghan battalion. Some paid. I mean, they're all paid, but some for mercantilist reasons, many for ideological reasons, and many because Iran has a large refugee population because Afghanistan is next door and it's abusing this population and getting them to go abroad to get money to send to their refugee population in Iran as remittances. And this all-Afghan brigade, you can basically have a shoeless Afghan child be part of Iran's foreign legion in Afghanistan. And you think about this network that Iran gets to have through intelligence, through this Quds Force, which is the foreign operations unit of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, married with the Russian-provided military capabilities of the Syrians on the ground, coupled with Hezbollah decisively intervening in Syria, coupled with Iran's Shiite, Arab, and non-Arab proxies, coupled with Russian air power, and you see a fundamentally new war machine in the Middle East, where the state doesn't have to formally be involved, but it can cobble together a different patchwork of men, money, and munitions, and have its interests attained and its ideological imperatives move forward. And in a place like Syria, that means standing with the slaughter of the Assad regime against its own people and being able to do so in a low-cost, high-return-on-investment way.
Dmitry.
Hi.
Oh, yes.
Ali Khamenei is not a young man, he's not a well man. What's next? How, you know, after him?
Excellent question. If you asked me that 10 years ago, I wouldn't be that worried. I am quite worried today. In July, Khamenei turned 80. I think also in late June or July, Khamenei, there's only been two supreme leaders in Iran, but Khamenei became Iran's longest supreme leader, having served 30 years from 1989 until present as supreme leader. So while the Islamic Republic is a product of Khomeini's revolution in 1979, the Islamic Republic of today, the update part, is fundamentally more a product of Khamenei's remaking of Iran than Khomeini's revolution. And one of the ways Khamenei remade Iran was that he brought the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, more into public life. Banks, businesses, politics, guys with guns running banks, businesses, and politics. And so that has led many people to assume that it could transition into a military dictatorship. It's not my thesis, but it is a thesis in Washington. Another thesis is, of course, that you could see more of the same. Think of continuity, but on steroids. Have another religiously ill-prepared, so not sufficiently studied in the Islamic sciences, cleric who has the support of the security services occupy this position and force him to, with the passage of time, cultivate a new power base. Khomeini had charisma. He could cultivate anyone he really wanted to. Of course, he had the security state behind him, but he had charisma, definitely. Then Khamenei comes in, lacks the charisma, definitely lacks the religious credentials, brings in these men to support him, and there are debates as to does he control them, do they control him, is it symbiotic? There's a plethora of different scholars who produce a plethora of different books that I could recommend to you, each one advancing their own case. Is it one tail wags the dog, the other one, how much of a leash does one dog give, was one master give the dog, and so on and so forth. Another possibility is, of course, internal combustion. The reason I would not be worried if you asked this 10 years ago, not, I mean, there'd be worry, but the reason I would be able to bet more on continuity is because some of the men that had made the Islamic Republic were also around then, men like Rafsanjani. And the reform movement, again, had a greater wind behind it then. Reform has moved more towards revolution. Reform itself has proven itself unable to reform. There's more, I would say, if you had to straw poll, you had to venture to guess, there would be more forces behind an entire systemic change. And the question is, would that population of the downtrodden and dispossessed, plus their brethren, their more urban, educated, middle-class brethren, unite under such a flashpoint while max pressure is going on for a kind of fundamental change? How messy would it be? It's fundamentally an unknown. It's an intelligence question for any country that has interests in Iran. It's an analytical question for anyone who's made a career watching Iran. And it's a dumbfounding question because Iran actually, per the Islamic Republic, you know, it's not a place where rule of law is particularly ascendant, but there is a process for selecting the next supreme leader. There is a body called the Assembly of Experts. These men are supposed to convene to monitor the supreme leader's performance. Clearly they're not doing that, or they're derelict in their duty. But also they're supposed to pick the next leader. And the question is, will Khamenei's kind of stack the deck in that body of men that are already pro him? There really is no heir apparent. And ultimately, in 1989, when Khomeini died, that body was able to be steered by then Iran's charismatic speaker, come president, Rafsanjani. So will a strong man within that body emerge to push the body towards a different candidate? And ultimately, because the fundamental rules were ignored in 1989, isn't the norm again going to be, well, let's just ignore the rules? So there's so many different spin-off scenarios there. But one thing is certain, that when it may not have been a systemic flashpoint 10 years ago analytically, I think today it is.
Jacqueline.
Can I ask you, from the American point of view, what now happens with this Bolton no longer on the scene? And if I may, can you just talk a bit about Saudi Arabia and where that is in this?
So the Bolton question is interesting because even when I'm in Washington and you get asked about different administration figures, I often have a similar refrain, which is I don't like to do Kremlinology, you know, to figure out who's high, who's down within the administration. Yes, it's clear Bolton had a much more hawkish worldview than most, but not all, of the Trump administration staff, as evidenced by his TV interviews, radio interviews, writings, being a public figure prior to becoming National Security Advisor. And when he became National Security Advisor, it was like a month or so after that he entered the position that the U.S. left the deal. So really, you could tell he would steer the ship. I'm not sufficiently well-versed in some of the bureaucratic minutiae beyond that point, but you can tell even this person who had a fundamentally hawkish disposition, and the Trump administration has been tough on Iran, but you could say the Trump administration's policy is behavior change, and Bolton, in his public life, has talked about regime change. In his capacity serving public life as a member of the Trump administration, he has tacked towards the behavior change. So when he was serving, he was carrying out the behavior change request. So I'm one that doesn't see the bureaucratic infighting as much as some of my other colleagues in Washington. So his departure raises more questions than I can provide answers to. But I think if anything is going to happen, it's probably more of the same things that we talked about today, the continuity, Iran's response, graduated escalation, America's response, sanctions. So that norm will continue. The second, Saudi Arabia, is actually quite interesting. Would you care to elaborate on what about Saudi Arabia or this U.S.-Saudi relationship or Iranian-Saudi?
U.S.-Saudi Arabia relationship, but also you mentioned Yemen and Saudi being, you know, quite prominent in Yemen. But I'm more interested, I suppose, about the relationship between America and Saudi Arabia and how that plays out in Iran, but in the Middle East as well.
So, harkening back to history a little bit, the Nixon administration had this policy called the Twin Pillars Policy. You know, if you are historically, archivally inclined, you can go back and read, you know, White House conversations when this Twin Pillars Policy came about. But there's a line that Nixon said in relation to the late Shah of Iran, and it was, protect me. Protect me. That line speaks volumes. The Shah definitely was the guardian of these interests in the Persian Gulf, but also Saudi Arabia also had a role, also had a position, a much lesser position relative to the Shah, but nonetheless also had a position in maintaining the balance of power in the region, maintaining the forces of stasis in the region. And when Iran basically changed in 79, the other pillar grew in importance and in value to U.S. foreign policy and to not just mercantilism with the Aramco and oil, but also grew in importance for the region. And really since 2012, but also since 2015, 2012 when Saudi Arabia became more active in international institutions, 2015 with Saudi distaste for the way the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, was formed, and then with the war in Yemen, Operation Decisive Storm, the Saudis assumed a more hawkish foreign policy in the region, believing that Iran had to be pushed back, had to be rolled back, had to be contained. And the war in Yemen, like you mentioned, is the manifestation of this kind of sense of emboldenment. They haven't fundamentally prosecuted the military side of the war well. Even some of their regional partners, you can see the UAE having prosecuted the war differently. Now they're not necessarily part of the same coalition anymore. The UAE has withdrawn or is drawing down forces in Yemen. But nonetheless, Saudi Arabia believes that there has to be some sort of pushback on Iran in the region. And this phenomenon earns its support in Washington, in addition to that long-standing kind of being a pillar of stability in the region. But the pushback term is interesting because whether you're pro-deal or anti-deal, a hawk or a dove on Iran, you tend to find these very diverse groups of individuals talking about pushing back on Iran. But in the region, the U.S. isn't pushing back on Iran. There's two countries that are actually doing the pushback part. And it's fundamentally kinetic. It's fundamentally military. Saudi is one in Yemen. Does anyone know what the other one is?
Israel.
Yeah, okay, very good. It's Israel. Israel is doing it in Syria and perhaps increasingly in Iraq, and Saudi Arabia is doing it in Yemen. I think the Israeli way in Syria is more effective. With Iraq, it's going to become politically complicated because there's national politics. But in Yemen, Saudi Arabia has responded to the Houthi insurgent movement, kicking out the Hadi-backed government, the UN-backed government. They're now in exile in Saudi Arabia. And Iran has been able to use this conflict not to create a proxy, but to co-opt an insurgent movement. And it's Iran's provision of select systems to the Houthis in Yemen that has enabled Iran to bait and bleed the Saudis further, to drain them of financial resources and national reputation, and to be able to find a new partner in the region and to get a foothold on a different body of water that can also serve as a strategic choke point. The Red Sea, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, also is another critical body of water where oil passes. So Qasem Soleimani, a name many of you should be familiar with if you're interested in Iran, he He's the commander of Iran's Quds Force. Last summer, he threatened not the Strait of Hormuz, but he threatened the Red Sea. The entity that he would use to carry out that threat is the Houthis. And the primary target of the Houthis' ire has been Saudi Arabia.
Now we've got 2 minutes or 3 minutes left, so we've got time for a very brief question and a very brief response. Yes.
Sorry. Yes, thank you very much. Let me ask you a question. I want to ask you a further question about...
No, we've got to do one question and quickly.
Okay? Yeah. About John Bolton, because there was a very sudden announcement and the oil market, like the oil dropped about 3%. So it is about a timing because the Iranian president going to attend the United Nations meeting in about 2 weeks' time. So do you think that indicated America have a change of position and they made this gesture so make that meeting possible between Trump and the president?
Okay, so we're going to finish with this possibility of a meeting between the two leaders of the countries. Yeah.
So I don't see the firing or the removal of the resignation of Bolton as tied to a potential meeting or the oil market change that you mentioned. Iranian and American leaders have tried to use the UNGA to meet before. Khatami tried to meet Clinton on the sidelines of the UNGA in the late 90s. President Obama and Rouhani of Iran had a phone call in the aftermath of the UNGA in 2013 in September. It's not unheard of for Iran or America to try to use this as an opportunity. But I don't think the removal of a member of the White House would have been a green light to Iran because Iran's demands are quite clear. They've said publicly they want three things. They want respect, they want all the sanctions removed, and they want to be able to sell up to 700,000 barrels. So I think that's Iran's public red line. What is the private red line? We'll have to wait until the UNGA is over to see. But I don't want to guess for the sake of being wrong.
That's a fine point to finish on. Many thanks. There are a lot of people here tonight. There were many more questions, but we always finish on time, and that's what we've done tonight. So many thanks to Ben Tallyblue for a fascinating, comprehensive look over Iran and neighboring nations and a look back at the United States as well on the topic of Iran and the United States. We'll be pleased to publish a paper in the Sydney Papers online. And for tonight, thanks for a great performance here at the Sydney Institute. Well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.